why do we get a doctor that refuses to see a patient because of a clerical error? Or why do we get a death of somebody because the patient can't be admitted to a hospital?
What was the nature of your medical practice before you became a medical director?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because there wasn't much medical practice. It just means that not much is required to become a medical director. I was in the middle of my residency and took some time off and really didn't have any actual private practice or not much experience even in the hospital setting. But what I had was enough to be hired as a medical reviewer, which was my first job at Humana.
Why did you decide to become a medical director?
Well, it was more a decision that was made for me, I guess, as opposed to me being actively seeking that. I'd taken some time off to be with my children. We were in the process of adopting a child and getting custody of my stepson. And I was working, you know, various jobs that didn't require me to spend the night at the hospital. And one of those jobs was helping a hospital that had set up a utilization review process for its Medicare patients. And it was really out of that job that somebody approached me and said that Humana was looking for a medical reviewer to do something similar for the insurance company. And I did that for less than a year and then ended up the actual medical director of an HMO where I had far more responsibility, executive responsibility. So it just kind of evolved, I guess.
And what exactly does a medical director do?
Medical reviewer is a physician that, you know, looks at requests that come in from physicians and makes some determination about whether they're going to be approved or denied. A medical director is a little more encompassing, and as a medical director, I did everything. I wrote contracts for physicians, devised policies and procedures for how our plan worked. I reviewed requests for admission to hospitalization. I looked at data, did physician profiling, worked closely with the board. I mean, the whole spectrum of activities that would be involved in a managed care plan.
During your interview for the job or during any kind of training or orientation, were you alerted to the fact that an HMO might want you to just refuse as much care as possible?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because when I went for my interview at Humana, the first job I had like that, I was really very anxious about the fact that I didn't have an extensive clinical background. And although that had worked okay in the hospital because I had lots of support from physicians in the hospital setting, I was quite concerned about that in the insurance setting. And during my interview, there was not a single question that was asked about that. There seemed to be no concern whatsoever that I didn't have any kind of clinical background, you know, in private practice or extensive patient care. And in fact, most of the interview focused on, was I going to be tough enough to deal with angry physicians who I would be telling couldn't do something, and then telling me that my job performance was going to be evaluated based on my denial rate. And I was told that I was expected to keep a minimum 10% denial rate. And this was regardless of any kind of patient need. I mean, that wasn't even factored in. It was just a pure quantity. This is the target that I had to keep in order to keep my job.
And what was your answer when they asked you, would you be tough enough to deal with angry physicians?
Actually, he said, would I be tough enough as a girl? So after I, you know, recoiled from being offended at that, you know, I wanted the job because it was perfect for what I needed with the responsibilities I had with the kids. And I guess I naively thought that it would be similar to my hospital job and I wouldn't be put in these tough positions. So I responded kind of in good faith that what we were doing was going to be right for the patient. And I said I was perfectly capable of being strong when I knew I was doing what would be right for the patient. Of course, little did I know that that's not exactly at all what they wanted me to do.
But you didn't have any alarms sounding in your head that regardless of what was right for the patient, they were expecting you to turn down 10% of the physician's requests?
Yes, you know, I did. In fact, you know, the fact that we didn't talk at all about how this was connected to patient care, I didn't know where that figure had come from. I didn't know how they were going to track it, what would happen if I fell below it. I mean, there were all those questions that I obviously, you know, had when I started. And then later, you know, once I got into the job and saw what happened, I mean, I did ask questions. The primary question being, over a period of time, physicians learn new ways to do things. And so there were obvious things that needed to be denied in 87. But once physicians learn, They don't request those things anymore. So you don't have those requests to deny anymore. And yet, rather than us accommodating the changing behavior on the part of physicians, we just got tougher, which forced us into denying more and more necessary care in order to meet those quotas.
Let's say a young physician is ordering a bunch of tests just because this was taught in medical school, and you would normally deny that, and that doesn't affect patient care, but then you went across that line?
Yes. A better example for 87 would be that during that time, many physicians would bring their patients in the night before surgery and so that they could get blood tests and cardiograms and x-rays and things like that. And so the insurance industry said, we're not going to pay for that anymore. You're going to have to bring your patients in the morning of surgery. So it was really nice when I started my job, you know, because I get a lot of denials just simply by telling physicians I was denying the pre-op day. But as physicians learned and as hospitals accommodated and made it possible to do AM surgery, we didn't get those denials anymore. So then we had to start pushing into other areas, like telling people that they had to have surgery as an outpatient rather than an inpatient, or sometimes even telling people we weren't going to approve their surgery at all, even if it appeared to us to be medically necessary.
So what's going on here is you were expected to deny at least 10% of the care. Doctors were figuring out ways around it, and now it got to the point where you weren't cutting fat, you were cutting bone.
That's right.
Then came a fax from California. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, it wasn't a fax. What the system that was in place was that any time a Humana insuree had to go into the hospital, authorization had to be received from the corporate office. That's what we were charged with doing. So a request came in to one of our nurses from California for an admission to the hospital for a man with serious cardiac disease who was going to receive a heart transplant. And it was brought to me just like a usual computer sheet with any ordinary request. And technically, the doctors were there to make medical necessity determinations, which was, you know, we would look at a request by a physician and make a decision about whether this was medically appropriate or not. So I remember looking at this sheet and thinking, why is this here? Because who would ever do a medically unnecessary heart transplant? So I called the physician and told the physician that I don't know why I'm having to do this, but this is the process and this is your authorization number. And no sooner had I done that than someone came rushing in and said, no, the reason this ended up on your desk is because we've got to figure out a way to deny it. The patient at a non-participating hospital, which meant that it was a hospital we did not have a contract with, so we would have to pay full charges. And we can't approve this. So that just set a whole flurry of things in motion, and we ended up finding a little loophole or creating one, I'm not sure now in retrospect what we did, that enabled us to deny it based on a benefit decision. We were able to say, sorry, your contract doesn't cover heart transplants. And that's the way we managed to deny it.
Would it have been medically possible to move him to a participating hospital?
Yes, it would have. However, once we turned it into a benefit determination and said, you know, you don't have benefits for heart transplants, then we didn't have to pay for it, even if it wasn't a participating hospital. And I think the thing that bothered me was that, you know, I never saw the contract. I don't know if indeed that was the case. I have my reasons to doubt that it was the case because this man was in another state. He had been sick. He had been seen by other physicians. Humana had been taking care of him for the condition that got him to the point where he needed a heart transplant. And he was already on a transplant list, and he was referred to this place in California by his doctor. Now, why in the world wouldn't a plan alert somebody much, much earlier that, you know, you don't have benefits for a heart transplant, so we can put you on this list, but don't expect a heart because, you know, we don't pay for them. And that was not done. So the fact that all of this was done at the last hour and really seemed to be more of a contrivance in order to avoid paying for it at all, whether it was a participating hospital or a non-participating hospital. I think that really awakened me to what this whole system that I was involved in was doing.
Do you know how long the patient lived after that?
Well, actually, for years, I didn't even know the patient's name because the whole process was one in which these computer sheets would be generated. I have lots of market information and a few lines of clinical information, and they would come to us, and we'd have to act on them. And, you know, I might do 20, 30, 40 a day. And so I would never remember individual patient names, hardly. Maybe sometimes not even their states, because we did requests from all over the country. But when the Wall Street Journal did an article back in the fall, the journalists did some investigative work, and I had been asking people who formerly worked at Humana, and so we were able to track his name down, and through a data bank discovered that he had lived some 20 months or so, I can't remember the exact number of months, afterwards. He did not receive his heart transplant ever, and he died of congestive heart failure.
Do you feel in any way responsible for this man's death?
Yeah, I do. And I think that that was one of the things that sort of slowly grew on me as I came to learn more about, you know, what I was doing and, you know, my little place in this much larger system that was evolving. Early on, I mean, when it happened and even for months and years afterwards, you know, I think I was part of that culture that had been created to make me believe that I was doing a good job. You know, that was my job as a medical reviewer, was to find ways to deny care, to save the company money. And it really took a lot of study and research and reflection and sort of interior examination to finally realize that I was a participant in something that we weren't even asking the ethical questions about. And that, you know, this whole idea of having a doctor sit and make these kinds of life and death decisions under this guise of payment, it just really nagged me and eventually troubled me and eventually caused me to feel that what I did, those words, that denial that I stamped on the paper, effectively caused his death. I mean, it was no different than pulling a plug on a respirator.
How much did you save the company by denying that patient's transplant?
Well, I was told at the time that the cost of the transplant would have been around $250,000. Of course, that was in 87, and that would have been barring any kind of complications or anything out of the ordinary for what would be expected for a transplant. So it was $250,000.
What was the company's way of treating you after you did that?
Well, I had succeeded in proving that I was a good medical reviewer. I got a little note, a sticky note that said good work from a boss. And, you know, and again, you know, we had a whole culture where everybody's job was part of this much larger system of limiting or denying care to the extent possible. So when you did that, when you succeeded, that was a sign of good work. And, you know, everybody was quite happy that day because that was a big saving. You know, usually during a day I might have five or six denials and they might amount to a few thousand dollars depending on whether it was an admission or a pre-op day or whatever. To have a $250,000 denial, that's quite successful. It certainly convinced my superiors that I could be tough, I guess, you know, for a girl. It defined what a good medical reviewer or a good medical director is supposed to be. I mean, later that was confirmed in my other job, that to meet utilization goals, to meet cost calculations and goals, I mean, all that is part of my job performance as a medical director, medical reviewer.
The theory seems to be that back before managed care, there was too much utilization, and that's why the costs were going up. And so the answer to driving down the cost was driving down utilization. But is that really true in the long run, that money is saved that way?
No, and I think even in the pre-managed care era, although, you know, we talk about excessive utilization and costs driving all this, is that, you know, we never did the appropriate kind of studies to know whether it was excessive utilization, inappropriate utilization. I mean, there are all kinds of questions we still don't know. But what it did was it induced this very simplistic sort of response, creation of an entire industry whose sole purpose now is to limit or deny care in order to reduce cost and utilization. You know, a very, very simplistic kind of approach. And I think that the problem we have now is that we don't know when we've crossed that line between denying unnecessary care and necessary care. I mean, there's no plan in this country that tracks denials and the outcomes of those denials, you know, so that they can question themselves and say, did we make an appropriate decision in this case?
Well, there aren't those end studies, but there are some guidelines for denying care, right? It isn't just flipping a coin or saying we deny everybody who came in on an odd-numbered day.
Oh, no, no. I mean, we've advanced the art of denial to a high level of sophistication. I use the metaphor that if you imagine a funnel, and in this funnel you have a series of filters, and at the top you're pouring the premium dollars in, and at the bottom, what trickles out is what a health plan is going to pay in claims. And first of all, you have to realize that the health plan's entire goal is to limit as much as possible what comes out at the end. I mean, they even refer to that as a medical loss. And then these series of filters are just, you know, finely tuned denial strategies, all the way from creating criteria and guidelines that are so tight that you authorize very little, down to, you know, creating methods to make sure that the treating physicians themselves are limiting and denying and acting like company doctors.
Tell me more about these guidelines. Are they written by doctors?
Well, predominantly, most plans in this country use guidelines that come from an actuarial company called Milliman & Robertson. And they had the genius years ago to recognize that as plans became more intrusive into the actual delivery of care, they had to have something that gave them a basis upon which to approve or deny something. And many plans initially were doing this internally, you know, sort of patchworking together criteria that came from a variety of places. Then companies started springing up and saying, well, if we can create these criteria and then in turn sell them to the health plans, well, you know, we'll make a lot of money. And that's indeed what's happened, and they probably are the state of the art. I mean, they're the ones who gave us the drive-through deliveries and the 24-hour mastectomies, and they're constantly refining those criteria so that this is what plans use. This is one of the filters that they use when doctors call in and want to request a service or treatment for patients.
Would it be fair to say that accountants are making medical decisions?
Oh, yes. You know, on all kinds of levels, because, you know, we have an actuarial firm, basically accountants putting together medical criteria, and then at the actual plan level, you have accountants or the finance department setting utilization goals because that matches what financial goals they have. And then in turn, that drives the medical services department, what medical directors and the nurses do. So just across the board, it's all driven by accountants and persons in finance.
What is managed care doing to doctors as human beings and as ethical professionals?
Well, I think you have to start with asking, you know, what is managed care doing to our health system? And one of the things that it's doing is it's creating this very bureaucratic, dehumanized system that forgets that, you know, we're talking about people who are real human beings in the most difficult of human circumstances that involves either your own pain or suffering or someone else. So already you have a culture that separates itself from the reality of what we're doing. And then I think it builds over so that physicians, the actual treating hands-on physicians, then begin to see their jobs as just little cogs in this much larger system. And so I think that it's changing. It's changing people's way of viewing what medicine's all about.
The HMO was happy with you when you denied that heart transplant, but now that you are an expert witness, they're not so happy with you. Would you describe what's going on with your testimony?
When I left my last corporate job, I made the decision to know more about the healthcare system than the healthcare system knew about itself. And I didn't quite exactly know what I was going to do with that, but as things evolved and I asked questions and learned more, it ended up that I was able to actually assist an attorney in a case that he had, an HMO case, where a plan denied a man access to a neurologist or to an MRI, and eventually he ended up with a serious infection. And this was missed because he was denied access. And so the attorney just didn't know how to understand what was going on behind the scenes and how to interpret this. And so I did that for him. And one thing led to another, and now I'm involved in several cases where I do just that. I mean, I feel like I'm an engineer, you know, who goes in and looks at some complex system and then helps both the attorney understand it and maybe hopefully the judge and a jury. And there are just not many people who understand how the system works behind the scenes who can bring that kind of knowledge to bear, not just in the legal context, but even in the public arena where I can talk to legislators or media so that, you know, I can peel back the veneer and help understand what's actually going on. Why do we get a doctor that refuses to see a patient because of a clerical error? Or why do we get a death of somebody because the patient can't be admitted to a hospital?
Has there been any effort to trash your reputation as a doctor?
Oh, on a regular basis. I think every deposition is an attempt to do that. But I think in many of these cases, the facts are so egregious and the law is pretty clear in terms of bad faith or malpractice or whatever. And so what's left is to Dr. Roy Lindapino.
Can you cite an example?
Yeah, actually, the most recent example is involved the deposition I did back in the fall when my divorce was still in progress, and there were a whole series of questions that had to do with, you know, am I under therapy, and have I engaged in an adulterous relationship, and I mean, just questions that I couldn't figure out at first where they were coming from until I realized that the defense attorney had gone to the courthouse and had a copy of the divorce file. And although I was not the one who had committed the adulterous relationship, he asked all these questions that attempted to sort of attack me as if I somehow were responsible for the breakup of our marriage. And that was very unpleasant. I mean, it was still the whole divorce and everything that had happened with my husband's affair was still very acutely present, and, you know, just to have to undergo that kind of questioning, you know, in the midst of that was just, I think it was the most disgusting thing that I've ever experienced.
But what would your divorce have anything to do about you as doctor?
Nothing. one would think nothing, except, you know, the strategy seemed to be, you know, to communicate, one, that we know so much about you, we even have your divorce file. And that seems to be a kind of common strategy, so that somehow I'm supposed to be unnerved by the fact that they have the depth of knowledge about me that they have. The second thing, I think, is to upset me. So that if I'm upset and they've managed to bring up something personal, then I'm not thinking clearly and I can't analyze the issues and express my opinions in an effective way. And so then they've sabotaged me in that way. I think the third is that, you know, a lot of this is driven by an attempt to sort of find something that can be used to discredit me, for example, in front of a jury, so that they could say, well, you know, she talks about ethics, but in fact, isn't it true that you caused the divorce or, you know, whatever. It means a lot of it's a fishing expedition. But they ended up actually putting my ex-husband and his divorce lawyer on the witness list for that particular trial, and the judge overruled it. Makes no sense, except if you just see it in this larger context of trying to destroy the reputation or credibility or opinions of somebody who's going to say something truthful about your company.
And another reason they might be doing that is to gag you. And we certainly have a history of HMOs trying to gag doctors, gag clauses in the contracts. Some of those gag clauses have been challenged in court, and they've been struck down as violating free speech. But are there still pressures on the doctors not to talk?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that, you know, what happened when we finally addressed the presence of these gag clauses was that most of the plans who had specific, explicit gag clauses in their contracts took them out. However, I read 10 contracts a week, and I still see what I call gag conditions. So there may not be explicit prohibitions against talking to a patient like there might have been 6 or 7 years ago, but there are certainly an entire culture is created through this contract in which the goal is to make the treating physician or the contracted physician a company doctor, so that you don't even have to put a clause in there to gag the physician. The physician will naturally silence him or herself because the interests are tied more closely to the plan. So that's what I see through these, you know, the financial arrangements, compliance clauses that say the physicians have to comply with policies and procedures and utilization management decisions, and just simply the process of selecting or deselecting a physician. Profiling physicians. It doesn't take long for a physician to realize that if you are outspoken against a plan, you run the risk of not having your contract renewed. And that's enough to silence most people.
And as a medical director, did you find yourself trying to kick doctors out of the plan?
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the first tasks that was assigned to me as the medical director of the plan after I left Humana was I was given this very lengthy report that was just full of all kinds of data errors to begin with. I mean, the whole report itself was fallacious. But I was given this report and told to pick out two doctors that we could terminate from the plan because we were under some financial pressure and we were losing money. And so the board had decided, or a small subset of the board had decided, that if we could terminate a couple of physicians and make a big deal out of it, that we could kind of use them as the scapegoats and send a message to the rest of the physicians in the plan, and that maybe that would spill over into improving their performance.
And would the plan have cared if you had put all the names in a hat and just drawn two?
Oh, no. They wouldn't have cared at all, because when I finally went back to them and said, this report that you have is just, it's fallacious and erroneous, and there is no way on earth that I can adequately defend the decision about a couple of physicians. And at one point, the executive director of the committee told me, well, just pick these two, and he pointed to two people. He said, because nobody will care if they're not on the plan.
What do you think is the answer to health care?
Well, I think the answer is that we are going to have to realistically acknowledge the nature of the current managed care model. It's based on limitation denial, and we cannot have a health delivery model that functions that way. That's going to be a major task, and I can't even conceive of how we could do that and get it, you know, beyond the political polarization and get past the amount of lobbying that would be done by the health industry to preserve status quo and all that sort of stuff. I think in the interim, at least two things have to occur. Is one, we have to have the ability to hold health plans and those persons who work in health plans accountable for the consequences of their decisions. So if there are bad outcomes to patients, and this comes indirectly or directly from policies, procedures, system decisions that are made by health plans, then there should be accountability for that. The second thing is that I think that we have to have a means to give the public a sense of more power and authority in what is happening to level the playing field. The most powerless group right now is a member of a plan. Things aren't disclosed. Things happen secretively behind the scenes, and sometimes you aren't even exposed to all this until you're faced with a particular consequence. And then by that time, it's too late, and you're at your most vulnerable point. You can't fight something when you're sick or overwhelmed by the condition. So I think those two things have to be addressed immediately.